Good evening. If you would please be turning in your Old Testament to the prophet Daniel. And go ahead and turn to the 8th chapter of Daniel. In the King James Version, there are 283 references to angels. The first four of those are the angel of the Lord, which is not a created angel, but one of the persons of deity. It's in Genesis chapter 16 that we find those first four references as the angel of the Lord appeared to Sarai's handmaid, Hagar, as she was fleeing from Hagar's wrath. The first time we have reference to a created angel is in Genesis chapter 19, where two angels came to the city of Sodom, where Lot was, to warn him and to bring destruction to Sodom and the other wicked cities of the plain. So there's a lot of references to angels, much about angels that we simply do not know. And that has triggered all kinds of wild speculation, much of it outright falsehood. That's all too common. But there are some things that we do know from Scripture about angels. We know, for example, that there are a great multitude of them. This Scripture in Hebrews chapter 12, verse 22, refers to an innumerable company of angels. And Jesus himself told Peter and the other apostles that if he wished to do so, he could petition the Father who would send him 12 legions of angels. Now, I'm not sure exactly how many a legion is, but it's a lot, undoubtedly numbering at least in the thousands. And so 12 legions would be more than you and I put together could count, even if we used our fingers and our toes to count those. That it's just going to be a larger number than we could probably even comprehend. We know from Hebrews chapter 1, verse 14, that angels are ministering spirits sent forth to minister to those who will inherit salvation, and that would be you and me. Now, in a time when God dealt extensively with miracles, angels sometimes appeared in visible form and did obviously visible things. For example, we think of Peter when he was imprisoned by King Herod. Herod had killed James with the sword and intended to do the same thing to Peter after the Jewish feast day. Didn't want to do that, you know, have a nasty execution during a feast day. That doesn't go over too well. But the angel came and released Peter, got him out of that prison, and the guards didn't even realize what was going on. And so that was obviously something that would be very tangible that an angel did. Exactly how angels minister to us today, I have the easiest answer to that question. I don't have a clue. I do not know, and it is vain to speculate on those things. As I said, there's just all kinds of wild ideas, but we need to rein those in and just acknowledge that we really don't know a great deal about specifically how angels minister to us, but we know that they do, and we ought to be thankful for that. Of these innumerable angels, there are only two in the Scripture that are named, and those, of course, are Michael and Gabriel. Now, Michael is referred to as an archangel only one time, that in the 9th verse of Jude. It is common to think of Gabriel as an archangel as well, but he is never called that. Is he an archangel? Same answer. I don't know. We don't have any direct reference to him as such. But in Daniel chapter 10, verse 13, we know that Michael is referred to as one of the chief princes. Is that the same thing as an archangel? Same answer. I don't know. I'm not sure. I think perhaps it is, but it may not be. So are there other archangels? Again, we really can't say for sure one way or the other. But what we do know is that angels are not fairy tale beings. Angels are real. And so let's look at the two that we can read about by name and see some things about them. And we will begin in the book of Daniel by looking at Gabriel, the angel Gabriel. You'll notice the E-L on the end of Gabriel's name. And you should know by now that that is the name of God. That's the short form of Elohim. And so God is known by the name El or Elohim, either one. And so this name, Gabriel, means mighty man of God. And he is seen only in the book of Daniel in the Old Testament and only in the book of Luke in the New Testament. Gabriel helped Daniel, the prophet, to understand some of the visions that Daniel had in chapters 8 through 12 of the book of Daniel. Now, if you've made a study before, and I assume that you have at one time or another, of the book of Daniel, that is not light reading, is it? That's complicated. And there are things in there that are profoundly difficult, especially for you and for me, because we are 21st century Western Hemisphere folks, and we're dealing with an ancient Near Eastern document written in what we call apocalyptic style. And we don't get along well with that. We 21st century Western thinkers like things to be cut and dried. If it says there was a ram and a goat, then there was a ram and a goat. Except there wasn't. Those were figures that are used to represent other things. And that's very typical of apocalyptic literature. If you've studied the book of Revelation very much, that is a classic example of a book. In fact, the very word Revelation, apocalypsis, it is written in apocalyptic style. And so there are just all kinds of things there that give us 21st century Westerners a difficult time. But anyway, in chapter 8, Daniel sees a vision. And there's a ram, and there's a male goat, and this male goat has a very large horn. And it gets broken off, and it's replaced by four horns. And this one of those four does tremendous damage to God's people, the Jews. Well, fortunately, Gabriel tells Daniel what that vision is all about. It's not about sheep and goats. It's not about a literal animal, a couple of literal animals, but rather, it is about the ram is the Medo-Persian kingdom and the male goat the Greek kingdom. And of course, they're going to come together and they're going to have a fight with one another. And you read about that, by the way, in chapter 8, verse 21, where the interpretation is given. And the great king that is represented by this single horn is the one that we would know as Alexander the Great, the Greek king. And at his death, then, when he dies, his kingdom is divided into four pieces. And so we have the four horns. And one of those was a Syrian kingdom. And in that Syrian kingdom was a very wicked, horrible, one of those horrible individuals probably that ever breathed air. And his name was Antiochus the Fourth, and he called himself Epiphanes, the bright shining one. He had a pretty high opinion of himself. No shock for a pagan king. That's the way it is. But this individual, this Antiochus the Fourth, Epiphanes, defiled the Jerusalem temple. He hated the Jews. He hated the religion of the Jews. He defiled the Jerusalem temple with idols. He sacrificed a pig on the altar, which of course was just an in-your-face to the Jews. The Jews, under the law of Moses, swine are unclean. Well, he sacrifices a swine on the altar at the temple. Totally defiled the temple. He forbade the Jews to worship as the law commanded them to do. He forbade them to circumcise their little boys on the eighth day. Again, the law commanded that. He forbade it. And if he found that a little Jewish baby had been circumcised, he had his soldiers kill that child and hang the dead body around the mother's neck and force her to wear that until it rotted off. Can you imagine such a disgusting, despicable creature as that man? I think he would have to say he's even worse than old Pharaoh, who said, keep the girl babies alive and kill the boy babies, throw them in the river. I would say this man was even beyond that wickedness. But anyway, long and short, there were five sons of the Jewish high priest. They were called the Maccabees. Maybe you've heard of the books of 1st and 2nd Maccabees. They're not inspired scripture, but they are historical books and valuable for that reason. These five sons of the Jewish high priest waged a 3-year campaign to overthrow those pagan authorities and to rededicate and cleanse the temple. And that is the origin of what we call the Feast of Hanukkah, which will be coming up here in December. And Jews will celebrate the Feast of Hanukkah. John chapter 10, verse 22, calls it the Feast of Dedication. And Jesus observed that feast. So there's nothing wrong with that. The Feast of Dedication celebrated the rededication, the cleansing and rededication of the temple after the defeat of Antiochus Epiphanes IV. So that's one vision. And aren't we glad that somebody explained that, said this is the Greek kingdom and this is the Persian kingdom and they're going to fight and it's going to be four kingdoms. And so we can understand that, and that's very, very helpful. Then in chapter 9 is another vision and prophecy of the 70 weeks. And that one is really, really complicated. When you read Daniel chapter 9, you might scratch your head and say, this is just too much. I can't deal with this very easily. And it is difficult. But long and short, this was a preview, if you will, of some events that would occur, starting with the decree of a king, a Persian king by the name of Artaxerxes, that said, you not only can restore the temple in Jerusalem, but you can restore the government of Jerusalem. The government of the Jews. And that we read about in Ezra chapter 7. This was several years after the decree of Cyrus that permitted the Jews to return from captivity. But it, long and short, this goes all the way from the restoration of the government in Jerusalem on through to the birth of Jesus, to the baptism of Jesus, to the crucifixion of Christ, and right on ahead to the AD 70 destruction of Jerusalem. Daniel had been praying in regard to the end of the 70 years of captivity. We know that the captivity would last for 70 years. That was prophesied. And so when it ended, Daniel was in prayer about that. He was concerned about it. And chapter 9, verse 23 there in Daniel indicates that Gabriel was sent to Daniel as a result of his prayers to explain to him what was going to happen. And I want you to notice there in that 23rd verse where Daniel is referred to by the angel Gabriel as greatly beloved. In other words, God really loves you. And he is invited to understand the vision. So hang on to that point for just a moment. And let's move on into chapters 10 through 12, which is the third time that Gabriel explains to Daniel what is going on. And this is in chapters 10 through 12, which is, again, a preview of things to come. And we have from the time of the Persian kings right on up through once again to the destruction of Jerusalem. Of course, the Persian kings followed by the Greek kings, Alexander the Great and so forth. And then after the death of Alexander, when the kingdom is divided four different ways, we have the kings in Egypt who were called the Ptolemies. There's a silent P and then T-O-L-E-M-I-E-S, the Ptolemies. And then there were the kings in Syria who were the Seleucids, and that's where Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes came from. This chronology that is given in Daniel chapters 10 through 12 is described in terms that you may recognize from the book of Revelation. A time and times and half a time, also called 1260 days, also called 3.5 years. And no, it doesn't refer to years on a calendar or days on a calendar. That's what we Western thinkers want it to mean, but it doesn't. In apocalyptic literature, that is a relatively short but adequate period of time for these events to take place. But now, Gabriel, interestingly enough, isn't named in chapters 10 through 12. But notice that the same kind of terminology is used in reference to Daniel. He is called greatly beloved, and he is invited to understand the words, just like in the previous section. So I'm confident that this is indeed Gabriel saying all these things to Daniel. Now, Gabriel, it says, this angel was battling the prince of the kingdom of Persia, chapter 10, verse 13. We might scratch our heads and wonder, well, what is that about? It would appear that this was an evil angel, or a demon, we might say, that was trying to influence the Persian government against the Jews. Because Gabriel refers to Michael, the archangel, as your prince, the prince of the Jews. So here's one angel fighting against the Jews. Here's Michael fighting for them. And it says he stands watch over the sons of your people, over Israel, in other words, chapter 12, verse 1. And evidently, it seems to me anyway, that good and evil angels have some kind of earthly influence over earthly rulers for good or ill. Again, if you ask me, well, how do they do that? I'm going to give you my stock answer. I don't know. But it would seem to me that that is exactly what they do. Now, we have an example in 2 Kings chapter 7 in a different time period, where the prophet Elisha is dealing with some enemies, the Syrians, and they have come against Israel. And Elisha's servant kind of hits the panic button and says, oh no, what are we going to do? And Elisha prays that God would open that servant's eyes, and when he does, there are all kinds of horses and chariots of fire. Well, that's not the Israelite army. That's God's army. And they are in battle some way or another. And again, don't ask me how that exactly that happens, because I don't know. How does that happen today? My favorite answer, I don't know. How does God deal with nations today? How does he use angels to influence that? I don't have a clue. Frankly, when I look at things in this very country, look at the Revolutionary War, look at the Civil War, look at World War II, all three of which, if it were not for the providence of God, we would have been in a world of hurt. We would have a whole different scenario than we have now. And so, did angels have anything to do with that? You got me. I don't know. But we do know that Michael is referred to as Israel's prince. There is at least the possibility, don't count Michael out here, that he still watches over God's people today. How does he do that? I wouldn't have a clue. I've never seen him. You know, somebody says, well, I saw an angel. I seriously doubt it. You'll have to excuse my skepticism, but I just really would doubt that. But angels do minister to us. I do not know how that is done. Let's look now in the New Testament as we wrap this up concerning Gabriel. Gabriel announces the upcoming conception and birth of John the Immerser, Luke chapter 1, verse 19, and the upcoming conception and birth of Jesus the Christ in chapter 1, verse 26. So Gabriel's chief duty seems to be helping people to understand future events. He does this for Daniel. He does it in the Gospel of Luke as he forecasts the birth, the conception and birth of both John and Jesus. He may be the angel that appears in Matthew 1 verse 20 as well to Joseph. No, not specified there by name, it would make sense if he were the one. So now let's take a look in the remaining few minutes that we have here at Michael the Archangel. Once again, notice the name Michael with the EL on the end. This name means who is like God. And he is referred to in Daniel 10:13 as one of the chief princes, which would indicate there are more chief princes. Whether that's the same thing as an archangel, I'll let you decide that because I don't know. Could be not so. But he stood watch over Israel, as we read from Daniel chapters 10 through 12, throughout the intertestamental period, the period from the end of the Old Testament until the birth and life and death and destruction of Jerusalem, that period of time, stood watch over Israel through that time, and may, as we said, stand watch over the church even today. I plead ignorance on that score, whether that's exactly the case or not. But what we know is that he contended or disputed with the devil in regard to the body of Moses. And we know that because of the ninth verse of Jude. That's the only place where that specific event is referenced, probably referred to also in 2 Peter 2:11, though not in the specific terms that we see in Jude verse 9. The interesting thing to me is that in Jude verse 9, we're told that he did not bring a reviling accusation against Satan. He said, the Lord rebuke you. In other words, he did not badmouth Satan. I think there's a lesson there for us. Satan is our adversary, to be sure. But he is a formidable adversary. He is not to be trifled with. And it is not a wise thing just to off-the-cuff smart-mouth the devil. I remember there's a song that the kids used to sing in vacation Bible school. I've got the joy, 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 joy down in my heart. And one of those verses said, and if the devil doesn't like it, he can sit on a tack. I don't think that's a wise thing to be saying. If an archangel who is way, way above you and me will not badmouth Satan, I doubt that you or I have any business doing so or teaching our children to do so. Now, what was the dispute about? It says he disputed or contended about the body of Moses. Here comes my favorite answer again. I don't know, because the scripture doesn't say. We can speculate all day long on what it might have been. At the end of the day, we simply don't know. What we know is that there was a dispute and that Michael would not bring a reviling accusation against Satan. He said, the Lord rebuke you. Now in Revelation chapter 12, verses 7 through 10, we see Michael and his angels fought the dragon, Satan, and his angels. That appears to be something that occurred shortly after the ascension of Jesus to heaven. If you read that passage, you see that the dragon attempted and wanted to kill Jesus at birth. Well, what does that remind you of? Remember a fellow by the name of Herod who sent the wise men to locate where Jesus was and bring him word. And his lie was, I want to come and worship him too. No, he didn't. He wanted to kill him. He saw him as a rival. And so Herod ordered his soldiers to kill every male child 2 years and under in the town of Bethlehem, trying to kill Jesus. He failed. And aren't we glad? He failed to do that. But it appears to be shortly after the ascension of Christ. And the fact that he entered the Holy of Holies in heaven and offered his blood as the atonement offering, so the price has been paid for sin, and Satan found himself kicked out of heaven. In the book of Job, there's Satan in the presence of God. Now here, we see he gets kicked out of heaven. It's kind of like God said, okay, the price has been paid for sin. Get out of my courtroom. Don't bother me with these accusations. Satan is the accuser of our brethren. And God basically says, I'm not going to listen to you anymore. The price has been paid, and I can justify these people if I so desire. Of course, God could do that anyway because he knew the price would be paid. But that's another subject for another time. Satan no longer has access to God in heaven, as he did in the book of Job. So, bottom line, angels are not make-believe. God has innumerable angels serving him for our benefit. Two of them are named, and we've talked about them at some length this evening. We've seen some of the things they have done and perhaps continue to do. We certainly don't worship angels. Remember in the book of Revelation, John tried, and understandably so, I'm not being hypercritical of the apostle here, but he did fall down to worship an angel, and what did the angel do? He said, no, don't do that. You worship God. So we do not worship angels. We do not pray to angels. At least we shouldn't. There are people that do, but that is an error. But we ought to be thankful that God commissions them to do good things on our behalf, even though we may not understand precisely how and what those things are. So I hope this has been interesting to you and helpful in understanding about Michael and Gabriel, the two angels that are named in Scripture. Gary has selected a song for our invitation. Let's stand together and sing that to solicit your response if you're subject.